I'm Ron Jordan. You're up to date, and this is WFSK Jazzy 88. I can go from 0 to 60 way too fast.
Who knew electric vehicle owners were having so much fun?
20 or 30 years ago, I owned a gas sports car, and this car is much quicker.
It's a great, fun car to drive. When you put your foot on the accelerator, it just goes.
They're fun, they're fast, they're efficient.
Visit driveelectrictn.org to learn how you can start having fun driving an electric vehicle.
Sponsored by the East Tennessee Clean Fuels Coalition, the Tennessee Association of Broadcasters, and this station.
A fraction of a raindrop, 3 grains of salt, at up to 100 times more potent than morphine. The tiniest amount of illegal fentanyl is all it takes to cause an overdose. Fentanyl can be mixed into heroin, cocaine, pressed pills, meth, and other drugs. It could be in your drugs, and you wouldn't be able to see it, taste it, or smell it. Learn more at cdc.gov/stopoverdose.
To protect his family from disaster, Steve used his camera phone.
Done.
By taking pictures of his important documents, Steve can always have them stored online. Learn more simple disaster prep tips at ready.gov. A message from FEMA and the Ad Council.
This has been a reminder from community-minded Jazzy 88 WFSK.
On the South Loop, the West Loop, as expected this time of the afternoon. Sometimes it stacks up already. 65 at Rosa Parks up by Metro Center. This traffic report brought to you by PensacolaBeach.com. I'm Commander Chuck with your on-time traffic.
Up with the guests and topics on What's the 411 with Sharon Kay. Friend us on Facebook and Twitter. Search under Sharon Kay's 411.
To speak with Sharon or our guest, the phone lines are open. Give us a call at 329-8810, 329-8810. Here again, Sharon Kay.
All right, in Nashville, Sharon Kay is in the house. Mighty glad to be on Jazzy 88 WFSK. Wasn't that a beautiful fireside chat, man? Even the students were like, yeah, Miss K, that was cool. And because, you know, they got something out of it.
And not to mention, because Makai, when you were speaking with earlier, he's going into education.
Oh, is he?
K through 12. That's his goal when he graduates.
Oh, then so he should have been paying attention. Oh, yes. Isn't that something? Yep. I did not think about that. Well, I was just happy to have her. And I've had Parkinson, Representative Ann, Representative Dixie Ann, and now later Camper. So I'm going down the list. I'm going down, and I'm circling back to my Davidson counties. You know, I got Senator Lady Gilmore on speed dial on my phone, and Representative Harold on my speed dial. So I'll be getting them as well. And when I saw Representative Love about a month or so, I said, I'm ready when you are. Okay, I said, okay, then don't be telling me you're busy. But anyway, let me tell you this quick story about her. Must have been earlier this year or last year. Some friends, a very dear friend of mine, you know who she is, was going to former Senator Dixon's funeral. You know me telling you about that funeral. And we got there early. And it was at the Ford family funeral. So I asked somebody connected to the funeral home, because we came in and we were just kind of there because we just got off the road. And when they had the thing on the funeral, they had an outside area that was covered that, you know, you could actually see through some of it. And so when we sat down and got comfortable, was getting ready to do that. Representative Leader Camper was coming in at around the same time. So, I quietly go over to the person that worked at the funeral home, and I'm going to say, I said, what's that lady's name right there? She looked like somebody I've seen before. Because I'm in somebody else's city. You know, I was supposed to have decorum. I'm at a funeral. And he told me who it was. I said, oh. I had been talking about her. I wanted to have her on. So I said, well, how am I going to do this without being so ghetto, you know? This is a true story. And because when she first got here, the reason why I didn't mention on air is when she first got here, I had to give her a 30-second recall on how she, that was you. I said, yes, ma'am, it was me. Because I was like, oh, what? There's no way I'm going to see this woman on at a funeral. And I want to have her on the show. Yeah. That is so
bad decor.
Oh, my God. This is so ghetto. But there was not anybody really there yet, but just us three ladies and then later Camper. So, because she was going to sign the book, you know, yeah. we were standing in line and stuff, you know, and I'm just like, that looked like her name on there, you know, when it's time for us to. So I went over to her, you know, after she got, you know, kind of in and settled. And I said something to her right as she was getting ready to sit down. She said, I said, aren't you State Representative Karen Kemper? And she said, yes, I am. And I told her I apologize. She said, sorry. And I said, I want you to be a guest on my show. I introduced myself who I was. I said, I'm from Nashville, and I work at Fisk University's radio station, WFSK, and I do this and this, and I want you to be a guest on my show, and would you do it? And she said, of course. Just call me at my office in Nashville. So, lo and behold, and that had to have been almost a year ago.
Okay.
So, I just, you know, because sometimes people aren't hard to reach, but several over the years, as people have come and gone up there, particularly the black ones, the black legislators, then, you know, I'm not from that region, so they don't know me like the Nashville people know me, and that's how I get to introduce myself to them. Because they don't see me every day covering the beat, but it doesn't mean I'm not doing the news. And I don't see them in the settings that I used to see, the conferences, and, excuse me, all the different things we used to have in Tennessee when Lois, the former representative, Lois DeBerry was alive, and the other ones, we used to have the black conferences. You hear me talking about that all the time. Well, they certainly did cut that out up there at the Capitol. And we couldn't have the caucus meetings and conferences and, you know, think tanks and all the stuff the black community used to be able to do. And then that's how we got to know who each other was across the state of Tennessee. Yeah. Oh, no, that doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, we're not going to let y'all come together.
No, don't not come together.
No,
yeah, that doesn't exist anymore. No. I'm talking about business people.
Yeah.
I'm talking about people who worked in education, who worked in healthcare, who own companies. Mm-hmm. That's the type of folk I'm talking about that were networking. Mm-hmm. Not, you know, in an educational setting. And, you know, different tracks
that was too powerful.
In the workshops.
Yeah.
And, you know, just to keep
That was a threat.
It very well probably was. But for the years that it was it went on, that, you know, we will go to places like Fall Creek Falls and, you know, wherever the state parks are, we would go there, State Park in West Tennessee and all these places, and, you know, just and have a nice dinner and, you know, it was just, and vendors. It was just fabulous.
Yeah.
I mean, that was an unbelievable portion that you would have enjoyed that so much because you'd have met so many cool people. And then all the speakers, you know, would come in from all over the United States. And I'm talking about the top shelf ones.
Is that the one where you met Dr. Claude Anderson?
Yes, it was.
Because I remember you telling me that story.
I absolutely did. Yes, I did. Dr. Claude. And matter of fact,
people were running up out of there.
Yes. Oh, my God. That was so amazing. I'm like, man, you scared those people, Dr. Claude. But one of the tracks I got to work on in the summit was I organize the economic development track. And so I would find my speakers and all. And I wanted him, because, you know, he's power, Mr. Powernomics. And Dr. Claude, he scared the folks. He scared black people and white people. They ran up out of that banquet hall because he was talking about becoming empowered in our community and then telling them some history about how it wasn't done. Yeah, I'll never forget that. I was like, man, they just left with the quickness. I never seen such fear. And instead of listening to what he had to say, because, you know, in some of his books, he does discuss those issues. Mm-hmm. And the Little White Lies book and other ones. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that. But it was just about getting exposed to some different kind of information. But that was hysterical, man. And we laughed about that. You know, just, though, I can't be in this room with all this going on. I got to go. People understood what was going on, and they were cool. But those are the days. Those were the days. And, you know, I missed that. But I'm grateful for the reconnect. There's several others that I had recently encountered that I'm going to be having on, so we can hear from a different set of voices. Because you all hear from all the right-wing, hate-mongering people who get these messages of roll the cart backwards and revising history. And, you know, there's more to us and the state of Tennessee than just that. Because that's all you're getting is all those right-wing talking point messages. So we're not a right-wing talking point station. Sorry. You're not gonna get that. Sorry. There's too many others out there doing it. That's just not happening here. Now, you know, it has been nice to not be freezing, don't you think?
Yeah, for sure.
63 today. How was it when you went out?
It was nice. You needed a jacket, but it still felt good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, good. That humidity's up. People are sure, you know, dealing with the sinus stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, they really are.
Because of that weather.
Oh,
you're warm a minute, then it's cold.
I know. And then the pollen, you know, the pollen is clowning. And, you know.
And then if you have to have a mask on, you know, like an intern, and you have a cold or something like that, that magnifies it, makes it worse.
Oh, yeah.
Because you can't get no air.
Yeah, because you're dry. Your throat is dry.
You can't get no air. So, yeah.
Yeah, your throat is dry. You just get dry.
Yeah.
And that happens, you know. So I get dry in this studio sometimes. And it just comes in here and just gets
stuffy.
Well, you know, I have to crack the window.
Yeah.
And I believe in a touch of breeze, just a little one, fresh air. But that's how it gets you. Mm-hmm. But here's what we're looking like. Tomorrow, 70.
Wow.
Okay. That's okay. Yeah. No mention of rain until tomorrow night. About 20%, I think we live that. But Friday, it just looks like it's going to rain all day Friday.
Wow.
Just in time for the weekend. But warm.
Okay.
68. Mm. Friday. Some of y'all will be out and about enjoying that.
Anyway, yep.
Yeah, oh yeah. 57, it goes down a bit Saturday, 57, and back up. 67. It can kind of stay there as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, just don't give us no more 20s and 30s, please. Mm-hmm. 63 overcast. You can tell the humidity's up, though, right?
Yeah.
I can tell it, too. A couple of things I wanted to mention before we get to talking to the author of the book, Gorillas Can Dance. There's a few things in the headlines here, Associated Press. Oh, wasn't our student wonderful?
Yes.
You know, I didn't tell him to tell his parents, but they'd have been proud of that young man.
Uh-huh.
You know,
they'll be able to go back and hear the podcast.
Yes, truly.
That's right.
I hear you hint.
Because that's what I told her, because, you know, not only will he tell him, but then he'll go back and tell him where to find him.
That's true. I was almost caught up, and then I got working on some other stuff.
Yeah.
Because I'm working on getting some new underwriters. So, you know, she and Kay been switching hats. But I wanted to mention, proposed out of Nashville, a proposed Tennessee ballot initiative that would have changed the selection process for attorney general has failed in a legislative panel. The House Civil Justice Subcommittee voted the measure down yesterday on a voice vote without any debate. It would have asked voters if the attorney general should be confirmed by state lawmakers after the current process of selection by the state Supreme Court. Mm. See, that sounds like a stack deck,
yeah.
Doesn't it? The proposed, forget the voters.
Yeah.
You know, just vote them in, yeah. And then they'll just
do whatever.
I mean, really? The proposal faced opposition from Republican Attorney General Herbert Slattery. He has praised Tennessee's unique system for supporting the Attorney General's independence and said the amendment would make the position a political office, and rightly so. Backers of the proposal said elected lawmakers should be involved. No, depending on what side of the camp, the island, things they're on. Lord, no.
That's the stuff they spend their time doing.
Yes. The answer to that is
goodness.
Yes.
Is there nothing better for them to do?
Apparently, you mean like make our lives more pleasant?
Yeah.
You mean that kind of stuff?
Pass some legislation to open up these lanes from 2 to 4 in some of these places.
Are you kidding?
Just this traffic in the state. I mean, so many other things that could be doing.
Well, a lot of the roads are federal. So, you know, they'll be taking a bow when Biden's little... money comes in and everything. They'll be acting like, yes, you see what I brought this home for you.
They voted against it, but they're going to stand there and say cheese.
Anyway, having said that, I think this is lovely. And I want to do a shout out to Meharry Medical College. Meharry Medical College says that it has received a $20 million donation. Now, that's the one to make the cash register go up and down. Yeah. Show us what you're working with.
Million.
Slap, slap. Yes. Now, last one. Donation. What? $20 million donation from philanthropist and author Mackenzie Scott. News outlets reported the historically black college in Nashville said Scott's gift will help it move forward as it experiences unprecedented growth. Look at what leadership will do. The college said in a statement that the gift will help with several goals, including developing a more diverse healthcare workforce, improving health equity, and delivering patient-centered care. Scott was previously married to Amazon founder and executive Jeff Bezos. So the Bezos dollars remain a holler in Nashville. $20 million donation. And the ex-wife is going to show you how it should be spent. Mackenzie Scott, girl, go on with your bad self. Now, Mr. Amazon, you're A to Z. Ooh, good. I wonder if he'd ever thought of anything like that. Maybe that's why they're not together. Anyway, as the world turns, so congratulations to Meharry. We expect great things. And Meharry Medical College, and y'all keep doing it like you are, and the blessings will continue to roll for you. Now, our guest is calling from China, and he is on time. Let the buses and trains be on time. I'm just really impressed. Shameen Prashantham, how are you today?
Hey, I'm doing great. lovely to be on your show, Sharon.
Oh, absolutely. He is Professor of International Business and Strategy and Associate Dean at China-Europe International Business School in Shanghai, China. So let me ask what time it is there, Professor.
It's 6:30 in the morning.
Oh, my. You got up early to do this. I appreciate you. Oh, wow.
I sure did.
Yeah, this is great. I'm glad that you were could make yourself available to us in Shanghai. Now, how long have you been in education?
I completed my PhD in 2005. And so I've been teaching at a business school ever since, so for a bit over a decade and a half now.
Now, you have taught at business schools and schools around the world. Where are you actually from?
So I was born in India to an Indian dad and a Sri Lankan mom. Before I turned one, we moved to Columbus, Ohio. My parents went to grad school, so my earliest years were in the United States, but then my parents moved back to India. They ran a mental health NGO, which just a few weeks ago celebrated a golden jubilee. My mother is no more, but my father is still running it. But then over a couple of decades ago, I moved to Scotland. That's where I did my studies and started my teaching career at Glasgow University, and now am in China.
Which one is the most memorable for you, where you are now or some of the other educational journeys along the way?
You know, each one has been very special in its own way. I think Scotland is where I discovered this phenomenon that I've been studying, which is about how big companies and startups partner. So that is always, Scotland will always hold a special place in my heart for that reason. But I've just been very fortunate, Sharon, to experience these different parts of the world.
Oh, most definitely. Now, let me ask if it's okay, because you are in Shanghai, China. Are you at liberty to speak about doing business there and what the challenges are? Are there any restrictions on your speech there?
Oh, absolutely not. Very happy to talk about anything to do with business here, indeed.
Has there been an impact that you have noticed there where you are as it relates to what's going on, the war, Russia's war with Ukraine?
So I would say at the moment it's been more indirect than direct. Mm. Actually, it's a little bit strange in the sense that while the rest of the world is coming out of COVID deciding to deal with life as normal, right now in China there's actually a bit of a surge in terms of COVID cases. Mm. So I would say at the moment what's affecting business the most is the rise of COVID. If you look at the numbers in comparison to other countries, the cases will sound very low. Mm-hmm. But the country has a zero COVID tolerance policy, probably the last country to be pursuing this. So at the moment, I would say that that's the big issue. As far as the war is concerned, I think people are watching with concern. Mm-hmm. And obviously, the potential knock-on effect in terms of inflation and so on could be an issue. But day-to-day, right now, the main issue, I would say, is that, compounds and buildings in certain places like Shanghai are being shut down. And actually, they're trying to do this in as thoughtful a way as they can. They're trying to avoid a situation of shutting down mm-hmm. the entire city, which is the case in some other cities in China right now.
So is the institution that you teach at, is it in that stage? Shut down?
So, actually, I'm the director of the MBA program, so I'm probably at the heart of dealing with these issues because the MBA is our only full-time program. So some of our students are on campus and they are being looked after well, but they are confined to the campus. They can move about freely. They can use the gym and so on. And then some of the students are off campus. So our classes are sort of, we've gone back to the old hybrid mode of some people in the classroom, some people online, and we're managing okay for now. With the part-time executive programs are on hold for now.
Okay, okay. And why is that? What is the reasoning that that you know of, that you've heard, that this cases are surging there? And what impact, and knowing we're 2 years in, what impact do you expect that to have on business there and globally?
So I think, from the start, the objective here was keep things under control, restrict cases. So given that policy, what they call a surge here was probably, in sheer numbers going to sound very low. I remember in November we got an email to say there are now 3 cases in Shanghai, so everybody needs to be careful. And when I got this message, I was with an Italian colleague of mine, and he burst out laughing and he said, "Oh, back home in Milan, we have more than 3 cases just in my building, my apartment building."
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, that's the first thing to understand.
Okay.
What is called a surge here is just a normal occurrence in other places. And I think that the main issue is that, they want to make sure that the health system doesn't get overstretched. So that's just a different philosophy, I guess. But the impact on businesses is definitely problematic. Fortunately, China is a very digitally savvy place, because people leapfrog the PC era. Everybody uses mobiles and access the internet, and so it's actually pretty sophisticated in terms of deliveries. So a lot of businesses are still able to do things either through working from home or using e-commerce heavily. There are some things, of course, that can't be done in that way, but will there be an impact, a short-term impact on business? Yes. But just like we saw 2 years ago when COVID originally showed up, a lot of people are able to use digital technologies to keep going in a lot of respects.
Well, and let me say that it works well for some businesses, but some have discovered that not so much. And does your book respond to any of that?
What you just said is absolutely right. I think there are winners and losers, and this is true of many things. I think the pandemic is the latest of these, but I think this was true of digitalization as it developed in the last decade or so. I think it's been true of globalization. And in a sense, my book, which is about how big companies partner with startups in a bid to become more entrepreneurial and innovative themselves, is about how companies deal with these broad challenges like globalization, like digitalization, and now even the pandemic. And so to that extent, I guess the key message of the book is, if you are, as a big company, wanting to be more entrepreneurial, well, first of all, you can do things yourself, but you can also engage with people on the outside who are. And in at this time of the pandemic, I would say 2 things. One, companies have actually had to develop even more digitalization capability, and this is more relevant. But the other thing is, I think what the pandemic has done is to remind us of how difficult it is to achieve what the United Nations call the Sustainable Development Goals, but just how important they are. And so, in fact, what I think the pandemic is reminding us all is of the importance, not just of pursuing economic payoff, but also social impact as something that businesses do.
Now, your title is interesting. I was like, what in the world? Gorillas can dance. I was like, okay. So I had to shift just for a quick second to when you start talking about Microsoft and other big corporations, okay, I get it. and it was very deceptive at first until you read the subtitle. Now, did you ever work for one of the ones that you write about in your book?
I did not, and in fact, that is one of the things I'm proud of, that I've written this as a neutral observer. Along the way, you know, a couple of companies were interested for me to pursue consulting projects for them, and I said, till my book is done, I don't want to do that, because I want to be able to say I was a completely neutral observer. And as for the title, actually, the origins line, a conversation I had over 15 years ago with a famous professor, I had just begun to observe big companies engaging with startups, and I, you know, as I just finished my PhD, I was early in my academic career, so I asked him for advice as to whether this was a phenomenon worth studying, and his response was, I don't think these smaller companies have a choice, they need to learn to dance with the big gorilla. So I latched on to that and wrote an article called Dancing with Gorillas from the Point of View of the Startups First. And I think it resonated with a lot of people because there's a hint of danger there. Startups can get crushed in the process.
Yes.
So, you know, but now the book has over time my research began to look at the perspective of the big company as well, and the book is written to the big company, and so it's called Gorillas Can Dance.
Well, and that's kind of what I was wanting to ask you about. It's for both, really, technically for both audiences. As our city, Nashville, has changed, business community has leaned more toward the gorillas in terms of the bigness of a lot of the big companies that are moving their headquarters and things here to Nashville and the middle Tennessee area, there's going to be some dancing with gorillas going on for startups in this area in order to, or partnerships or something. So the lessons that your book can help in terms of understanding if they're coming into your region or if the big corporations are already there. Is it for both audiences, Shamin?
You know, I think that you're absolutely right in that there are important lessons for both audiences. Most explicitly, I've written for the gorillas, but the startups who want to dance with the gorillas, the better they understand the perspective of the gorillas, the more likely they are to do so effectively. And, you know, I can't claim to be an expert on the startup scene in Nashville, but in preparation for our conversation, I've been reading up a little bit, and it's the sounds of it is that there's an exciting scene developing. One of the things I was interested to come across was something called Project Music, which is an initiative of the Nashville Entrepreneur Center to cultivate startups that are relevant to the music industry. I think they have an accelerator program and, you know, seems to be, have continued even during the pandemic virtually and so on. And it strikes me that, as you say, there will be increasingly scope for gorillas to dance with startups and for startups to dance with gorillas.
So do you, I guess in because you have three chapters, and you know, this is really like as basic as you can get with part one, or not chapters but parts. Why, part two how, and part three where. I mean that it just can't get any more helpful to you all that are even thinking about or considering this than that. You start in chapter one with why entrepreneurship matters for large corporations. Tell the audience what they will find in that chapter.
Right. So the starting point for why a big company would consider engaging with a startup is because they face a lot of disruption. in terms of the business environment. Digitalization has meant that you face new forms of competition. The world is changing very fast. Consumers have new and changing demands. Plus, the pandemic hasn't helped, certainly. So the importance of being nimble and agile as a big company has never been greater, and yet it's very difficult to do that just because of the nature of big companies. Now, there are many ways to try to become more entrepreneurial. You can encourage managers within the company to take risks, to be more, take initiative, and I think that should happen. But that doesn't have to be the only way companies try to do this, because there's a lot of great entrepreneurial energy on the outside. And so that's what the opening chapter is about. You know, the recognition that there's a lot of disruption, and in fact, for big companies, it could often come from startups on the outside. But instead of looking at them at the, as the enemy, you know, they can also be co-opted as allies.
Well, what, in your opinion, or even in your book, what are some of the things about each other that the corporations know and don't know about the entrepreneurs and the startups, that and vice versa? What do the startups and the entrepreneurs need to know about how the corporate realm runs itself?
You know, that's a great question, and that's in fact what I get into in the second chapter, because each part, as you nicely put it, there are three parts: the why, the how, and the where, and each part has two chapters. So in that first part, while saying that there's an imperative for big companies to be entrepreneurial, what I then go on to point out is actually there's an interesting challenge, because the very reason that makes it attractive for big companies and startups to engage with each other, which is that they have very complementary capabilities, also can come in the way of doing so. So the big company has the scale, it has the reputation, it has the legitimacy, things that a startup would find interesting to tap into. The startups have the agility, the creativity, the novelty of ideas, which the big company is interesting in. So on paper, that actually sounds really great, but then when they start working with each other, they find that they are, these very differences make it problematic, and I call it the paradox of asymmetry, the very thing, the very differences that make it difficult, or attractive to work together, also makes it difficult, or at least not straightforward. So I think that's important for both sides to understand. It ain't going to be easy.
That's the facts. Neither is anything worth doing or having. On page 41, in that very chapter, you have your book nearby you, right?
I do, yeah.
You write, it's under inaccessible learning opportunities. You write, even if corporate managers recognize that there could be some win-win scenario in working with a startup, one of the classic difficulties arising from the way large corporations are structured is hierarchical and specialized. And tell us more about that section of your book.
Wow, you've read the book carefully, Sharon. Thank you. So, if I took a step back and said, okay, so you have these asymmetries, now what? I think basically the big companies, and indeed the startups as well, need to understand, so what are the asymmetries? And in the book, I highlight three. One is an asymmetry of goals. They want different things and at different timescales. There's an asymmetry of structure. They are very different in terms of their hierarchy. So if two big companies want to talk to each other, it's not so difficult for, say, the vice president marketing of one company to identify who their counterpart, the vice president of marketing of the other company is. That's the asymmetry of structure. And then there's an asymmetry of attention, in the sense that big companies see a lot of startups. They don't know which ones are worthy of their attention. The startups know who the big companies are, but struggle to get the attention of the people that matter. The section that you pointed to is the second of these three. It's about the asymmetry of structure. Mm-hmm. So here the issue is that, I have come across so many startups that have wasted 3 to 6 months going from pillar to post trying to identify who within the big company they should be talking to.
Right.
And part of the challenge with this structure asymmetry is the point that you drew our attention to, which is because of that, it becomes difficult to even make the relationship happen and take advantage of the mutual learning that is possible.
Well, and knowing that that's the case, do they scout out if a corporation such as the ones, you know, Oracle, whoever's come here, is do they scout for that on the front end, or do they wait until they're already here and then they say, oh, by the way, we want to work with startups and the entrepreneurs so we can be part of the community? How does that go?
So, I mean, that's basically what the how then becomes, why the how becomes relevant.
Okay.
And I would say in the early stages of my research, this is exactly how it happened. In many cases, it was sort of happy accidents, or it was, you know, big companies kind of, on second thoughts, let me also cast my net around and see if I can find any startups. But today, the companies that are very serious about engaging with startups are much, much more intentional about this.
Mm.
And they take the how very seriously. And so what I found is that to address these three asymmetries, they do three corresponding things. So first of all, keeping in mind the asymmetry of goals, the big company has to clarify what the synergy is. What is the win for both sides? Everybody talks about win-win, but, you know, what the win for each side is sometimes not specified clearly. And then in terms of the asymmetry of structure, which is what we're talking about, they create an interface, which I will explain in a moment. And then in terms of the attention asymmetry, they try to develop exemplars or success stories.
Mm-hmm.
So that interface, the middle piece, is really about having a first port of call for these startups. So at Microsoft, it's an entity called Microsoft for Startups. At the German automotive company BMW, it's called BMW Startup Garage.
Mm-hmm.
And so these entities, yes, they do scout around for startups. But because there is a clearly visible entity that is interested in startups, some startups can even get in touch with them directly.
Well, and for diverse firms or minority-based startups or entrepreneurs, is it tougher for them to get, you know, in that door or get that relationship built because, you know, they're dealing with issues for the diverse community?
You know, I think there are some gorillas that are now so mature in this process of partnering with startups and fairly clear about their objectives that I would respond to your question in a couple of ways. So one is that there will be some gorillas for whom certain startups will simply not be relevant. And so irrespective of the diversity angle, you know, if you're not doing things in a particular domain or, you know, that might not be interested to a certain gorilla, then I don't think there's going to be much interest. But there are other gorillas that take a much broader view of their interest, and this would be true of, say, Microsoft.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I have seen there, there has been a lot of interest in, for example, working with startups that have women founders. In South Africa, they had a program that was particularly targeted at black-owned startups. And in fact, right before the pandemic, they launched a program, a global program for social entrepreneurs.
Mm.
And so I think there are opportunities, but certainly, you know, it's not going to be the case with everybody.
Right.
But I think there's a very important role for startups from diverse backgrounds and opportunities that are there. Not as plentiful necessarily, but certainly there.
Well, how would you describe Amazon? I know they're guerrilla, but how would you describe their relationship with startups and entrepreneurs?
You know, Amazon is not one of the cases that I got into deeply, partly because it's sort of a relatively, let me put it this way, some of the companies that I was studying are a little bit older than that. You know, so Microsoft is nearly 50 years old, and it was about these companies that were trying to deal with disruption and so on. But whichever company is trying to engage with startups, they need to realize that they are competing with other gorillas for the hearts and minds of startups. And so that's going to be extremely important.
Okay. And you have... And something else that you include in here are these charts or the grids. And I'm looking at the one on page 102, the purpose, the people, and the process, the startup partnering capability building process. What is this about? And tell us how it should be used.
Sharon, I really am impressed at how well you've read the book.
Well, you can tell I've done this for a living, right? You can tell.
indeed, yes, absolutely. So, you know, the how has two parts. One is what I talked about a moment ago, which is understanding the need for a systematic process to address these asymmetries. But the other part is then developing the capability to do this repeatedly, as opposed to as a one-off exercise. So the chart that you were pointing to, the table, is about this latter issue of how can a company develop the capability to partner with startups. Many big companies have developed the capability to engage or collaborate with other big companies. So when you think about how to now embed this as something we can do time and again, it's important, first of all, to initiate the process. And here, you know, it can actually begin as a bottom-up initiative. In many companies, I've seen middle managers just come up with the idea and, in fact, go ahead and do something on a small scale. But then secondly, this initiation has to lead to expansion. And at this point, it's important to get the buy-in of different stakeholders within the company, including the leadership, if the process had begun as a bottom-up activity, and then finally to systematize it and make it relevant to the core of the strategy. Otherwise, it's really not going to make an impact. Now, when you think about each of these, the initiation, the expansion, and the systematization, it's important to think about the purpose, people, and process, and each of these are different, and that's the point of the table. For example, the people who help get the process started may not necessarily be the best people to run startup partnering once it's becoming systematized.
So what do you see? We know that COVID is going to be with us for a while. Just from your work and research and, of course, being a professor, what kind of strategies would you, besides buy your book, Shemaine, what kind of strategies could you, like, give a couple of bullet points for people to be looking for in 22 as they go to 23?
Well, I think the first, undoubtedly, is to continue to take digitalization seriously. I remember when the Microsoft CEO was doing a call about the quarterly results at the end of the first quarter of 2020, by which time, you know, COVID had become a pandemic. He said, we've seen more digitalization in the last 2 months than we did in the previous 2 years. And I think COVID accelerated this importance of digitalization. And of course, one of the worries is that we also have a digital divide that is growing. So everybody, I think, should really up their game in terms of their digital skills. Okay. And digitalization is in fact one of the big drivers of what I've been studying, which is the reason why big companies and startups are working together. The other thing I would say is it's still very important to emphasize the human side of all of this, because one of the things that COVID has robbed us of is the opportunity to meet in person. Of course, this is now, there's some return to normalcy in some parts of the world, which is great, but a lot of people have not been able to travel to other parts of the world and see each other. And I think, you know, digital is great. It's wonderful that we are speaking now just on a regular telephone line, and it helps to bridge the distance. But I hope someday I have the opportunity to come over to Nashville and say hello to Sharon Kay in person, and that would be a completely different experience. And I think keeping an eye on the human side of things and doing what we can to try and not lose that element. And you know, it's important for business to think not just about the economic side of success. That is important. But to also keep thinking about social impact.
Absolutely. And no trip to Nashville is worth it if you don't see me, okay?
All right. I'm not arguing with that, of course.
That's me. You just definitely can't just pass through here and not talk to the lady that interviewed you at 6 o'clock or 6:30 in the morning.
Absolutely, yes.
Shameen Prasantham. Thank you so much. Tell our audience how to find the book and to keep up with your work.
Well, thank you for that. There's a website, www.gorillascandance.com. I'm Shameen Prasantham, and you can find me on LinkedIn, and don't hesitate to reach out.
Okay, excellent. Thank you so much. And is this when you get up at this hour in China, or is this when you get a few more minutes of sleep?
No, I'm normally an early riser, so
okay.
This was not abnormal.
Okay, good. So you're gonna have a good day and a good start, and thank you so much for being with us today. Okay,
thank you so much, Sharon. Okay. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Oh, you're welcome. Bye-bye. And I'm just Bye-bye. Impressed with the fact that he was on time from Shanghai, okay, in a whole other time zone across the world. Now, what will we say about people that, you know? Anyway, having said that, thank you to Professor Shameen Prasantham of the International Business and Strategy. And he is a professor of international business and strategy and associate dean at China Europe International Business School, author of the book Gorillas Can Dance, Lessons from Microsoft and Other Corporations on Partnering with Startups. I'm glad he was able to say something about a Nashville startup.
Of course.
Because he did a little bit of research, so, you know, they may not even know they got a shout out. You never know what you're going to hear on this show, y'all. Anyway, that's all we have for you. You all have the very best of the best. And don't forget who loves you.
You've been listening to What's the 411 with Sharon Kay. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station and its management.
What's the 411 with Sharon Kay?